One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Everybody, and thank you all so very much for joining us here today on Expanded Perspectives with me, Cam Hale. And as always, in studio alone, the man that drinks more different variations of crystal clear water than any human being I've met in my life, it's Water Fizzy.
How's it going, everybody? Yes, I'm here in Skeleton Studios. Yes, I do. I am drinking, let's see, this is called Rain Pure Mountain Spring Water. Let's see what it says here.
It's you're not doing an ad. Put the water down.
Sustainably sourced.
Yeah, because it's rain.
It gets colder faster because it's an aluminum can.
Get out of here. Well, at first I thought you came in with like a Coors Light.
BPA-free liner. Infinitely recyclable.
Put that
and it's
down.
Made here in America. So this thing's pretty cool. Never had it before. I'm not going to lie, it tastes like a lot of other waters I've had.
Just like water. I don't know what's wrong with
water.
It, folks.
I love water.
We can
and
tell.
So every time I see a new one, I'm like, oh, bag it up.
I gotta try it out.
If I'm driving down the road and I see a store and a sign's in the window with a different kind of water.
You gotta try it.
That I've never seen, I'm like, U-turn.
Just so y'all know, I'm gonna go ahead and let y'all in behind the curtain a little bit on the youth of this fellow. He was the same way with beer and liquor, just so you know. He just now gotten older and he does it with water.
Now I do it with water. You're correct. Back in the day, I was always trying new flavors.
Yeah,
right?
There was
different
all the
IPAs
liquors. If I wanted to see any new whiskeys, it was always at the house. Y'all had it rode up, all different kinds. So that was always one of those deals. Now you're grown and you just decide to do it with water.
Well, a lot of that comes from, I had a second job for a long time with a friend of the family owns a liquor store here in the town we're in. And the town we're in was dry when we were kids. So it didn't become wet till we were like 20, 21.
Oh, yeah.
And so I started working there, helping them. It started as I was doing a favor to help them out. It was like a holiday and they were shorthanded.
And how many years did it turn into?
Yeah, like 10. And it ended up staying on. I mean, I actually really enjoyed it. And I got to meet all kinds of different sales reps and try out all kinds of different wines, liquors.
Well, you became a sommelier almost.
I did. I had no idea about wine. I never had an interest in it, didn't care. The only wine I drank was at communion. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But the person that owned the winery there, or the liquor store, had a vast knowledge of wine. And she taught me all kinds of things. I didn't know anything about terroir, you know, things like if you grow this variety in this region of the world, it tastes completely different than if you grow the same variety in a different part of the world. And I had no idea about any of that, but I learned a lot and I had a good time. Until this day, now I still have a big love for wine. Like whenever I have a steak or something like that, man, nothing's better than like a glass of red wine.
That's
to go with it. It goes with it. Speaking of vineyards and winery and stuff, I've been spending a lot of time in my garden. And man,
I've noticed. I saw the pictures.
It has exploded due to a lot of the rain we've been getting.
For real.
But man, I've got so many vegetables that I don't know what to do with them.
Man, oh man. Yeah.
Especially tomatoes. Now, I know you hate tomatoes, but I...
But I love hot sauce.
I love a tomato. Well, then I can hook you up with some if you want to make some salsa.
They call it salsa.
Yeah. Salsa. Yeah.
Are you a chunky salsa or a real, like... Blended, well-blended salsa.
I prefer well-blended.
Same.
I don't mind a chunky one, but I prefer well-blended. Yeah.
I like it to where that's how I like this, exactly the same. So, hey, look, I got to share something with you.
Okay.
We always make jokes on here all the time.
What are you talking about?
You and the headlines, right?
We don't make jokes?
Well, yeah, we always make jokes on here. We always make jokes. We're having a good time. It's always you and the headlines because you know I love to hook you with a good headline.
Yeah.
It's my favorite thing to do. I have another one for you.
Oh, I can't wait.
You ready?
Yeah.
You ready for this? Mm-hmm. Insect-eyed kangaroo-monkey hybrid was seen in Merrill, Michigan area. That's right, folks. Got an insect-eyed kangaroo-monkey hybrid.
This is getting out of control.
Yeah.
I think that there is a secret lab somewhere, and they're using CRISPR technology to make these hybrids. Continue.
Like the island of Dr. Monroe. Or Moreau.
I apologize, folks. Yeah. My allergies are bad today.
Yo, he's dying over here. Yeah, I believe it's right. This has got, Lon sent this to me. All right. Now, Lon received this. It says, "Hey, Lon, in recent years, there have been multiple sightings in my small town of Merrill, Michigan, of something that doesn't match a single cryptid I've read about. Now, I personally have not seen it, but I have talked to three witnesses that I would put my life on, and I really want to know about this thing. The first witness is my uncle, and he's the main reason I'm on this hunt. When he was young, he used to take night walks in the neighborhood's woods right before sunrise, as long as it was dark enough and no neighbors could see him. He would take a very dim flashlight with him on purpose, and if he thought anyone saw him or was following him, he'd put his hand over it and hide in the darkness of the woods. He claims...
Sounds kind of creepy.
That's kind of what I'm wondering. Like, what are you doing out there, bro? Just going for a walk. I'm sorry. I was just going for a walk.
But I don't want anybody to see me. And if they if I see somebody come, I'm just going to hide.
I see you. Yeah, what are you doing out there, dude? Are you going out there making number three? So anyway, this is what he says. He said he claims that the main thing that scared him were the raccoons and the possums. Just a bunch of grinners running around, huh? Said he never had problems with people on his walk, but he still knew the risk of trespassing. Though his story isn't very exciting, he got the best view of this creature out of all three witnesses, claiming that it only stood a few feet tall and had legs bent backward with large, bulbous, insect-like eyes, and the rest of it looked like a kangaroo and a monkey hybrid. Says many cryptids are close in visual, but none of them have thick hair and big eyes like this one had. So I showed him some drawings of other look-alike cryptids. He dismissed every one of them. He claimed that he was walking out in the woods just as it was getting brighter. The sky was gray and the woods were still dark from the trees, but the road was almost visible down the whole mile. He says on his way across the road back to the house, he saw the thing a little ways down. He said he'd have to cross the road in two steps. Despite being short and disappearing into the woods, my uncle had just exited. Now he says that the second witness is deceased now and that he was a natural conspiracist, so it came up surprise.
More than one person saw this thing.
Oh, yeah. His description, he said, was much less valuable. I have the belief that this was the same cryptid, though. He said a couple of miles away from the very first incident, the man said he saw this very small ape-like creature jump almost to the top of the trees. And he said, this is the least resourceful sighting because he goes, I cannot ask the man to answer since he's passed away. And then he leaves it with this one. He said, the third is my grandmother's good friend, Sylvia. She lives at the state away. Said every 4th of July that they would park a camper in my grandma's yard and stay there for a week or two to visit with all the friends and family they had left behind after they had moved. Says keep in mind these folks have never heard of these stories of this creature, and for this story, I was in the house as it happened. Sylvia's husband had a few drinks with my grandparents. There's a big tree on the side of a barely used road. Said he walks over there to use the restroom. And as he's standing by this tree, he notices some big black bug-eyed thing that my uncle had seen. He said it's staring him down from a tree line across the road. Now, as soon as he focuses on it, he says this thing just backed up into the brush and was gone. So me and my uncle freaked out about this, as you would. And as crazy as it sounds, me and my whole family believe and know where this creature is. Says we've even narrowed down exactly where it calls home, or possibly where it calls home, based on the sightings. Says if you've got any ideas, please, thank you, F.
Wow, that is an interesting sighting. There's a couple things about the story, though, that I don't understand. Your uncle goes on these walks in the morning before daylight.
No, just like another guy. His uncle was the one peeing, I believe. Or the friend
this
of the
guy,
family.
And he's scared of raccoons and possums. Well, if you're scared of raccoons and possums.
Yeah, why are you walking?
Don't go.
Maybe you shouldn't carry the flashlight. That way you can't see them.
Why don't you? I understand if you're walking for health reasons. Go when it's daytime.
It sounds like they were young. He's young at the time, too.
And if you're scared of possums and raccoons, like how many times are you going to, before you're not scared anymore, and you're like, yeah, it's a possum.
Maybe you're going to meet a special someone and just didn't want to tell the boy that.
Now, I would be scared if I saw an insect-eyed kangaroo-monkey hybrid. Now, that's something to fear.
So I still love the fact of what you brought up is, I don't know. I like the idea of there being like crazy CRISPR monsters that have been released, right? Now, that may be the adventuring, stupid D&D, crazy fantasy mind that would be a great story. But how else do you explain seeing something like that?
I can't.
Let me ask you this. Could it be aliens taking these animals and then monkeying with them and doing whatever and then dropping them back off because they were done with them?
It could be.
I don't know. I like to think about that.
I got some good news for you, Cam.
Okay. What
You're
is
gonna
that?
Be
all
excited.
All the sharks have gone vegan.
No.
Okay.
We got an interesting email. Check this out. It says, good day. I hope this message finds you in peace and good health. I got your contact on internet during a serious search for a trustworthy personality.
Please tell me that I need to send some money to help a prince.
I'm Jolima Wind. I'm 23 years old, and I'm the grandson of Fode Senko, the rebel leader of Sierra Leone.
Whoa.
Which opposes the government of former President Ahmed Tejan Keba. I have been a refugee. I'm currently in Porto Novo, Benin, due to the political war in my country, which caused the death of my mother during the war. Now, my father decided to deport me because I am an only child and I lost my father on November 25th of 2023. Now, during this war, my late father made a fortune selling diamonds to the tune of $10,200,000. The money was kept secret at the ECOWAS security company in Porto Novo, Benin, due to the political problems and unrest that still exist in Africa. I cannot invest these funds alone, so I'm asking you and Cam to please help in placing these funds under your care for investment. And I'd like to add here that if you agree, 40% of the total value of the fund will be yours.
Ooh!
Less all expenses incurred. Now, during to the clearing of funds in Porto Novo, Benin, 40% will be around $4,080,000.
We're rich.
I hope to hear from you soon. Can you believe that?
Did you send them to our bank account?
Absolutely, I did.
Oh, we're set.
I said, dude,
we're set.
This is a chance of a lifetime.
Maybe we can email them back, see if we can interview them.
We are going to be rich. So that's good news. I hope you
good news. That's good news.
All right. I hope you enjoyed that. So look, listen, folks, we may not be podcasting too much longer because I'm telling you, when we got to split $4 million, I see a lot of fishing tournaments
and stuff like that
in our future.
That's right.
A lot of other stuff. So you have to forgive us if the podcast comes out very slow. But I got another story for you.
Yes.
Have you ever?
Wait. We getting more money?
No, this one has nothing to do with money. This is a crazy sighting that takes place in Mexico. Have you ever heard of El Chavarin?
No.
I hadn't either, but check this out. It says, while I was living in Mexico from 2004 to 2007, in the town where I lived, there's a lake in some hills where people go barbecuing and hanging out with their friends and family. But one of the things that caught my eye was the white crosses around the lake. I asked family and friends on different occasions, what were those crosses for? And they told me it was for people who had drowned there. I was stunned because there was a lot of crosses. I thought that maybe they didn't know how to swim or something, or people got too drunk when they got into the lake. But my cousins and friends told me stories that people were going out for a swim and they started drowning. Now, supposedly, some of them yelled that something was pulling them down. I thought maybe it was branches they had got caught on. But what was weirder to me was that when I asked my aunts and uncles, they added more to these drownings, telling me that not all the bodies could even be recovered. I thought that was weird because the lake is big, but not so big that people can't be found. Two rivers connect to that lake, one that goes into the lake and the other one where the water can leave the lake. But there's a border dividing it from the lake. It's tall enough for water not to escape, but people can go over it with ease. One of the stories was of a man who drowned, and they were able to recover his body. He was purple by the time they found him, but he had strange and unusual slash marks across his chest and stomach area. That left me intrigued. If it was true, or if people were just trying to add to the lake incidents, I wasn't sure. Now, being a teenager, I couldn't just go around asking questions, and to be honest, I never remembered when I visit there now. Now, this is my uncle's story. After knowing that I was asking many questions about what was going on with the lake, he told me something that happened to his friend when they were teenagers. He said that his friend had invited him to go fishing at night, because that's when fish are more accessible to catch, since they get close to the edge. He told him no, because my grandma had grounded him. Later that night, after midnight, my uncle heard banging on the door, and the doors out there were made of metal, so it shook them pretty bad. Now, my grandma and uncle got up, and my uncle got up and went to the door and opened a little window on the door to see who it was. It was his friend, wide-eyed and pale. My uncle asked him if he was all right. He said he looked like a ghost, and my grandma told him to bring him inside. They sat him down, calmed him down, and asked him what happened. Where was he coming from? He told him that he went to the lake alone, on his bike with his fishing gear, and was out there camping, hoping to get some fish. But he wasn't having any luck after a couple of hours, so he decided to leave. He was on the other side of the lake, so he had to go around. It was a bright night, so that he could see the dirt road. He was going around the lake when he saw something come out of the other side where he was going. Now, at first, he didn't pay much attention to it, thinking it was a turtle or perhaps a giant iguana that roamed around those parts. They grow to about 3 feet or 4 feet long and look even bigger when it's in the dark. So he was riding along, looking over to see this thing come out on all fours. He saw how it had wet skin, and it was shining due to the moonlight, and how it had a short reptilian tail. The best he could describe it was as if it had a stump of a tail, but it was wide and odd-looking. He couldn't tell if it had a neck. It looked stocky from its upper body. He was just looking at how huge this lizard was that just came out of the lake when all of a sudden it stood upright on its rear legs. That's when he got scared, because he could tell it was big. He estimated it to be about 2 meters or 6'7". He made a noise and this thing turned around and looked at him. It had big, big red eyes. To be able to tell they were red from his distance, he knew they had to be large, and he was about 20 meters away. He started pedaling hard with all of his fear, because to top it off, this creature was downhill from the only road that led him out from the lake, and it was just staring at him, following him with its stare. As soon as he was parallel to the creature, he gunned it down the road and didn't look back until he got to my grandma's house, which was closer than his house, just 5 minutes away from the lake on a bike. He stayed over and left the next day, still shocked. Now, I was doing some research, and I came across a legend a few months ago after my uncle told me his story, and it left me stunned because it was too much of a coincidence with everything I had heard by then. The legend takes place in Ameca, Jalisco, Mexico, and it's about a fisherman named Lucio, who was struggling to provide for his family, and he had to make a deal with the devil. He found gold soon after, but got paranoid with time and thought his family was just with him for the gold. Since the day he made a deal, he has always carried around a snake. So one day, he took his gold and snake, and the people in town saw him jump over a bridge into the river, but they never saw him again. The legend goes that he got transformed into this lizard-like monster with big scaly skin, red glowing eyes, a small tail, and he is the cause of people drowning in that lake and river that connect to the town. The town I was living in is only 30 minutes away from where this legend takes place. Thanks for all you do, Javier. So, wow, there's a legend of this reptilian man. It reminds me of the Bishopville lizard man in South Carolina. And there's all these people that are legitimately drowning in that lake. And this dude's uncle's buddy saw this thing come out of the lake at night walking around.
That is so, man, that's unsettling is what it is.
I mean, if it's a real story, it's creepy. El Chavarin.
Never heard of it.
Never heard of it. I love when I come upon these new legends and folklore from these areas. And, you know, if it is a legend in that area, how did the legend get started? That's what I always wonder. What's the patient zero? You know what I'm saying? What started it? Was it just merely somebody goofing around trying to scare their kids and the story grew from time? Or
a drowning and then somebody just took that from there and it's built upon it?
Yeah, right. I mean, we know lots of stories are created to keep kids from swimming and doing things in dangerous situations. So they make up the story to keep the kids. But Man, I don't know. A giant lizard man walking around. I hope it's real. I hope a guy did make a pact with the devil.
Whoa.
And he wasn't happy with it because it never works out. And he was transformed into a lizard man.
Into a lizard man. A lizard man needs to settle down. Folks, let's take a quick break. When we get back, I'm going to be talking about some strange disappearances, like some rock and roll UFO ties. It's just a little different, and I think you're going to enjoy it. Let's take a quick one. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
All right, what is going on, y'all? Like I like to preface things, let me back up here before we even get into this and tell you that when I was a kid, I wasn't raised on rock and roll, okay? My father was not really, like, he listened to a little of it, I guess, but he was a country guy. Right. Like, I was raised horses, cows, spurs, boots, saddles, all of that, all the cowboy stuff you can imagine. That's how I was brought up. That's what we always had. Everything, like, my father had every book Louis L'Amour had ever written. If that tells you anything, had a huge library. I grew up reading Louis L'Amour, all of this. Everything was cowboy. Right. That was it. That's the way he was raised. That's the way I was raised. This whole deal. It wasn't until I met Mr. Filson himself, through his family, that I was really introduced to 60s rock, to old music, hippie music, if you will, right? That's the way it was when we were kids. We were taught it was hippie music. But you have to understand, we were pretty close to the hippie times. So it was through him that I'd found, and his family, that I found all kinds of artists, the ones that they listed, people that I'd never even heard of before, right? Like, I didn't even know who the Doors were. No clue. I didn't know who the Doors were. I didn't know who Jimi Hendrix was. I didn't know who Iron Butterfly was. I didn't know any of these musicians, any of these artists. And it was just spending time with him. We would listen to it. And I mean, it was, they listened to everything. His family listened to, you know, they had country and rock and all that, but they had a much more eclectic view of music or listening music than my family had. My father had and all that. So it was fun to really get to hear it. So I tell you all of that. Now, if you don't know who Iron Butterfly is and you've never heard of Inagata Da Vida, well, do yourself a favor and go listen to it. You can find it on Spotify. You can find it anywhere you're listening to us. If it's got music, you'll be able to find Iron Butterfly's Inagata Da Vida. Now, it's titled Inagata Da Vida, which is supposed to be in the Garden of Eden. But the story goes that the lead singer was so blasted when he started singing it that that's the way it came out. It's a crazy song. The entire length of the song is like 16 minutes, I think, long. It's great. I've got the intro queued up here right now that I can play for y'all. I'm iffy about playing it simply because you know how the music, you know how everything gets crazy. You only have a few seconds of playing it, right? Before anybody goes nuts or you get pulled. Let's try this. Y'all want to try it? Let's see if I can get this working here. Hold on here. Let me get a little volume set. Let's get a little of this turned up. Let's see what y'all, see if you can recognize this. Let's see. So that's kind of the intro, right? Y'all remember any of that? If not, I'm going to leave it right there. I don't want it to get too carried away. I don't want us to get in trouble for it because it would easily happen. Of course, I'm at the helm, so it'll probably happen. Anyway, I tell you all of these things because we've covered it in the past. We've talked about it in the past. Rock and roll has some wild history, right? They have some really, really interesting things that have gone down with musicians. So I'm going to talk about a few of those. This one in particular, well, they're all pretty sad, right? I mean, there's some very sad rock and roll stories. This is one of them. What's funny, though, about it is it really wasn't a lot of rock and roll-based stuff. Philip Taylor Kramer, matter of fact, was actually a bassist for Iron Butterfly, but not during the recording of Inagata De Vida, not in all that time. It wasn't until 74 is he joined, and he had made a couple of albums with them. And then he left the band not long after that. Like, I think he only stayed with them for like a year or so. And then he ended up going back to college, and that was that. He just, you know, was in the right place at the right time, gifted musician, got to, you know, dip his toe in it and see what it was like and hang out with the guys, made great friends with all the dudes that was in the band. You know, this whole deal was probably awesome. That year and a half was probably a banger, right? Like, you can't imagine how much fun it must have been around that time. So Mr. Kramer leaves, right? Bounces out of there. He goes on back to college, but he's not your normal musician, right? No, he goes back and gets a degree in aerospace engineering. Yeah, now that's something else. So he gets his degree in aerospace engineering, gets him a job, comes out of school, he's got a job. He goes to work for a little old company called the U.S. Department of Defense. Yeah, wrap your head around that. So I'm assuming, we can safely assume, you go back to college, you get some time. If he goes back, let's just say he went back in 76, right? So you know by 80, he's got a job working for the DOD. Maybe even beforehand when he got it. We're not real sure. I'm not real sure. I'm sure that his family is. I'm just not. So he gets out of there. He got that. In the 90s, he decides, you know what? I think I'm going to start my own business. I'm going to start a multimedia company. And that's exactly what it does. It's called Total Multimedia Inc. And it works on video compression technology. It works in a lot of these things that he was interested in. And of course, this is around the time, you know, you've got to imagine it. It's video is really getting its legs under it, right? You're talking about where its cameras are getting more affordable. They're getting more and more into people's homes. It's getting to where this is the turn. This is right around that little hook when everybody started slowly becoming content creators. Even back then when they realized, like, oh, I can shoot movies myself. We can do our own small movies. Like, you don't need all that we had led to believe. So, of course, that's what he got into. He's helping get along this. Fast forward to February 12th, 1995. Mr. Kramer was going to the airport to pick up a buddy of his named Greg Martini. What a last name, right? Last name of Martini. And Greg had brought his wife along, too. And they were actually going to get picked up. They were all going to go back to Mr. Kramer's home, spend a little time there. He, you know, talked to his wife, the whole thing. They were all coming over. They were going to hang out. They were working together. Mr. Martini and Mr. Kramer were actually working together on some ideas. See, here's the crazy thing. Mr. Kramer had been working on facial recognition technology. Now, it's assumed that it had started during the time of the DOD, of him working there. We're not really sure, but he was extremely ecstatic about it. His wife had even talked about how he had told her the benefits of facial technology. He was excited for the fact that it would help missing children. Philip was so excited that he couldn't hardly stand it. He told his wife, could you only imagine if you could show a picture of a child to a computer screen, take a picture, upload it, and then in groups of thousands and thousands of people with the camera streaming and scanning, it could pick that child out. If that child was missing, we could find it in groups of thousands because of this technology. He was so ecstatic, right? And why not? Why not be proud of that? And of course, it's back and forth of if that's what he was working on with Mr. Martini. There's things that go down. But here's where it gets weird. He never met him. He never met the Martini or Mr. Martini's wife. He never picked them up. Never any of this. No, what ended up happening was he calls home from his office, right? He calls his wife. He says, hey, look, plans have changed. Calls him up. This is all that he says. He just lets her know that whatever happens, I'll always be with you. That's all he tells her. And then he hangs up. And then he calls Ron Bushy. And now Ron Bushy was the drummer for Iron Butterfly and one of his closest and oldest friends. And he called him up and he says, Bush, it's Taylor. And I love you more than life itself. And then he just hung up. That was it. Two phone calls, done. Now, the family reported that Mr. Kramer had been working around the clock, that he had been going sleepless for weeks leading up to this whole disappearance, that he was just really pushing himself, probably for this technology that he was grinding on. But whatever it was, Mr. Kramer didn't even go to the airport, turned around and left. And it was at 11:59 a.m. he calls 911. And this is what the reporter, or this is what the operator had said. This is what he had said. He says, this is Philip Taylor Kramer, and I'm going to kill myself. And he hangs up. And that's it. Now, I'll stop right there because I have a few questions, but I'll tell you what. I'll keep going, and then I'll tell you these questions at the end. So you jump ahead. Police go crazy, right? The police are sent out. They start, you know, they track down his office. They know where the call comes from. They do all this stuff. They can't find him. Talk to the family. They can't find him. They look. This goes on for a little bit. He's gone. They don't have any idea why during the time that he was supposed to be at the terminal to pick up his friends, everything was going great. He's gone. They have no idea. It's later revealed, after some digging, that they believe his company was in bankruptcy. So they were like, okay, well, we think this is probably what affected him. Maybe he did really take his own life. That's not what the family thinks at all. The family doesn't believe that at all. His wife, the brother-in-law, the brothers, all of this. No, his father, nothing. They said, this isn't like him. He would never do that. They said, look, I understand him being depressed. I understand him being down, but this was a dedicated family man. He would not walk away from everything that he had worked so hard for. But 4 years later, after this he goes missing, 4 years later, it's actually on May 29th, y'all, they find, when I say they, I'm talking about a small group of hikers. They're in a canyon about a mile and a half east of the Pacific Coast Highway when they notice something that shouldn't be there in Malibu. It's a Ford Aerostar van. This van is at the bottom of this deep ravine. So they slip up on this vehicle, like, what's it doing all the way down here? Surely somebody didn't run it off the road. They get down there and there's remains inside it. So they crawl back out, go and make the proper connections to the police and whatnot, send them down in there. And that's him. They identify through dental records that this is Mr. Taylor. Mr. Kramer. So what they start breaking down then, and his brother gets right in the middle of it. His brother's like, dude, this is not him. He would not have done this. And this tells you nothing. And even on the death certificate, all they can put ruled out, or all they can rule it as, is probable suicide. Now, his family goes back into the idea, and his father is unconvinced. Completely unconvinced of this being a suicide. He had told his father in private that he was having trouble with some people giving him some real issues, and that they wanted what he was working on, and that several of them had threatened him. And he made this actual statement, and this is something that really sticks out. He told his father, if I ever say I'm going to kill myself, don't believe it. I'm being forced into it or something. But he says, if I ever say I'm going to kill myself, don't believe it. I'm going to be needing help. So is this a code word that maybe he didn't let on everybody? Is this what happens? Is it because of what he was working on? You have to think about this. In 95, wouldn't it have been a lot easier? There's no cell phones. People's not carrying it everywhere. There's not as many people. There's not cameras on all the corners and buildings. Did they come to Mr. Kramer's office? Did whoever this was take him and drive him off into this area and then simply, push him? Did they strangle him? Did they poison him? What did they do and then just run him off in this ravine and leave him? or did he take his own life? Either way, it's a horribly sad story. But I tell you that to lead into another little mystery of a rock star. This rock star mystery is of a fella named Jim Sullivan. Now, Jim Sullivan didn't quite make the ripple in music that he would have wanted to. He didn't have the best luck at it. He had possibly some of the worst luck. Mr. Sullivan started making a music playing. He was more like a folk music kind of guy. Hung around a lot of the clubs, the folk music clubs in and out around there in California. There, especially in Malibu, he became like a local part of a club called The Raft there in Malibu. This is back in 1969. And he made tons of friends there. And I mean, like famous guys, Lee Majors. I don't know if you know who Lee Major is, all you young folks. If you don't, you can look it up. He was on a television show. Of course, he was a $6 million man and all that. But when I was a kid, he was on a television show called The Fall Guy. Dude, I watched that thing nonstop, right? The Fall Guy was just that. He was a stuntman. I think they're making, you know, movies about it now and the whole deal. But Lee Majors was the stuntman. It had, of course, what's her name? Is it Heather Locklear? I think it was, I can't remember. It was some blonde woman they had in there, you know. She was the heartthrob. They had the whole deal. Had the big, I think it was the big 4x4, the big blue Ford that would come jumping over. And it was great. It was a lot of fun. Well, this is one of Jim's friends. Not only that, Harry Dean Stanton became one of his friends. If you don't know who Harry Dean Stanton is, just pause, look it up. You'll know, right? Mr. Stanton was something else. That fellow was really something else. But he became such a major part of the scene right in that area that he even did a little cameo in Easy Rider. They brought him in, put him in there, the whole thing. It was great, right? He was living this little folk hero life right there in Malibu, and it was probably an amazing time. He writes a book. He writes a song called UFO. Yeah. And, you know, there was a lot of stuff going on at the time like that, a lot of wild music. So he writes this UFO tale song. And it goes in. I think he was actually trying to get picked up into, I can't remember the name of, the company. I had it down here, what I thought. But large record company, his wife worked for one, this whole thing. He had done a little bit of everything, right? He was from a Nebraska, like farming family was what he had done. And he had gotten into music, probably sitting around playing, you know, with the churches and all that, gotten into music. And there's when he kind of like, I think I like this. This is what I would rather do. I would rather make music than I would work the farm, right? And back then, that was a real solid choice. So he sets out to go do this. And it, like I said, it doesn't work out. He has glimpses of good times, which I'm sure for most musicians, especially those even listening, this is not something that's unheard of. It is a brutal business, right? I mean, it is very fickle and very tough. And so he keeps performing, but he finds very, very little success. And it just, he's still there at the Raft. He's going to other clubs. He's trying. Things start falling apart. He loses his wife. He starts losing a lot of stuff. He even starts going down the path. This could have been from drinking or whatnot, where he believes that other musicians are stealing his music, stealing his beats, stealing little points from his lyrics. He has all this stuff going on. So finally, he says, you know what? That's it. I'm done. I'm going to get out of here. I'm going to leave here and I'm going to go to Nashville. I think I would be better off in Nashville. And when I get out there, I'm going to make some money. And when I get this money all saved up, I'm going to send, you know, for my wife and my son. And I'm going to get them to come back out here with me. I'm going to show them, you know, that what I've done. I'm going to do better. So that's his plan. He packs up everything that he's got, everything that he can pack in his Volkswagen Beetle. Let's not forget, folks, he's driving a bug. He jumps in there and he heads to Nashville. So while he's headed to Nashville, like I said, now I tell you this because he's known for this song called UFO. While he's headed to Nashville, he pit stops along the way. It's unintentional at first. He's in New Mexico. I believe he's actually in Santa Rosa is actually where he's at. It's a pretty place, too. If y'all haven't been, Santa Rosa's pretty all right. It's 2 hours east of Albuquerque. It's there on Route 66. If you've never been down Route 66 or go through there, like you go to Tucumcari and work your way, dude, it's very interesting to see some of this stuff down through there. So he leaves. This is March 4th. March 4th at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, Jim jumps in his bug. They're in LA, got everything loaded up, and he heads out. And that's where he ends up. Turns out he gets pulled over early morning, March 5th. They're just right outside of Santa Rosa. He's stopped because they think he's drinking. They think he's hammered drunk. This is what's going on. Turns out it's not. They gather him up back then. This is old school days. They gather him up, take him into the police station, and they give him a sobriety test. Not even field sobriety, y'all. Just straight up sobriety test. They don't do it down beside the road back then. Nope. That's too good. We're bringing you downtown. So if you get in trouble, we just pitch you right over there, right? So he passes it. They were like, huh. Well, he's telling the truth. He's passing it. He's just tired. He had been on the road for 15 hours cruising at this point in his Beetle, right? So he's wore out at this point. So he says, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to go to this motel here, and I'm just going to go in there and check in. And he goes to La Mesa Hotel, gets him a room. And that's where it is. That's where he goes. Well, nobody hears from him. Nobody hears from him at all. So finally, they're like, huh. He should have been out there. He should have called. They start calling around. They find all this stuff out where they track it down to where he was. Turns out nobody even slept in that bed. The key was still found locked inside the room. So they start a search back in the day, looking around, trying to find out where he is. And somebody finally reports his vehicle. They report his Volkswagen ended up outside of town on the edge of a ranch, 26 miles from the motel. Now, here's where it gets a little strange. Some believe that he actually talked to some people that were out there. Some believe, you know, some of the ranch hands, some of that. Some believe, no, that he was just out there. When the police found his car, it was all locked. Of course, the engine's dead. You know, no telling how long it had sat there. Nothing's going on. There was a number of odd things still in the vehicle. Jim's wallet was in there, all of his clothes, all of the reel-to-reel tapes that he had, cassettes, his guitar, and a silver appointment book, and a box of LPs that Jim recorded in 1972 on the Playboy label. Yeah, that's right. Hugh Hefner used to have a little music label. Wasn't long-lived, but he had it. Dabbled in a little music. Got that going. Jim recorded some music on there. That's what it was. Now, it's odd people point out that Jim was so fascinated with the UFOs, and he wrote the song about the UFOs, and then he goes missing in the state where Roswell happened, right? So, Jim's family hears about this. Family and friends, they load up. They all go out. They all head up out there to New Mexico to help look for him. And they look like crazy. They're kicking over everything. They really do search, like, with a fine-tooth comb as much as they can. Nothing. Just gone. Jim's manager is named Robert Ginter. He was actually talked about starting during the early, or was quoted talking about the early morning hours of looking for him, and saying that one time said he asked, Buster claims that he asked, this is Robert, they called him Buster. So they asked Robert about, we're talking to Jim, and said, what would you do if you had had to just disappear? And Jim said that I would just walk off into the desert and I would never come back. Now, that is a very, very strange thing to say. But some people believe that he was actually taken, possibly, by a UFO. Now, I don't know if it's just because he wrote a song about it that he went missing and they just like, you know what? I like this whole deal. Here's the thing. With or without the idea of the UFO, everything that's going on around here is incredibly creepy because they've never found it. As far as I know, Jim's never been seen. Now, the odd thing is they did find remains in the desert during these searches. They did locate it, but it wasn't Jim's body. It was another body that they located. So Jim, as far as I know, is still missing. Parked his car 26 miles outside of Santa Mesa, New Mexico, and walked off into the desert and was never seen again. Never left a note, which it seems to be odd. I know that people put a lot of validity and a lot of weight on suicide notes. I didn't as I was younger, but as I've gotten older, I kind of have. I kind of have put a lot of weight into them. It seems like there's a, when they're not there, it's almost just a doorway that opens up to the strange and unusual. Right? When they're there, it's like a little finish wrapper, and then that's it. But when it's not, you get this. Is what happened? Did something lure him out there? Did somebody go with him? Why didn't they take anything? What happened? What drew him out there only for him to park and walk away? What stopped his dreams in the middle of it while he was there? I have no idea. But he's not the only one. I've talked in the past, of course, about people having strange interactions. When I see people, rock stars, musicians, actors, actresses, anyone, having these strange encounters with UFOs. This one's no difference. This one is the Red Rocker, Sammy Hagar. Yeah. Now, I know a lot of y'all probably Van Halen, not Van Hagar, right? Now, here's the thing that threw me the most. It wasn't about that Sammy had some sort of alien encounter, right? It wasn't that. It was the fact that Sammy Hagar is like 76. Yeah, that's the thing that got me. 76 years old. The Red Rocker, man, oh, man, I don't know why, right? I don't know why you just forget about it. You look up like, good Lord, can't believe he's that old. That's crazy. So this is what happened. Sammy talks about this one time a long while back. Took place like over 60 years ago. This happened to Sammy. Now, he was actually interviewed by a fella during this whole thing. It was they were in Las Vegas. I think he was opening up a place down there, one of his bars or whatever that he's got going on. And he was actually spoken to by a fella named J.C. Fernandez. And at the time, J.C. was host of Las Vegas Now, which was there on a Las Vegas television station. And J.C., this is how it goes. J.C. says, Sammy Hagar, I have to ask you the story that came out. I think it's actually in your book, talking about being abducted by aliens. Now, is that true? And can you expand on this story for us? And Sammy, being Sammy, without missing a beat, says, yeah, it's true. You don't go around saying stuff like that, you know. People will call you a nut. Says, you know, everybody that's ever asked me about that and expects me to try to backpedal it, but 100% it happened. It was 4 o'clock in the morning, pitch black, dead sleep. I felt like I was being programmed, like someone's tapping into me, like it was a string from my head to 13 miles up on a mountain place called Lyle Creek. And I know right where it was, these little foothills. There was an object there, and there were two people in it, two creatures in it. And it was, it was 19. I want to say it was 64 and 65, whatever, I guess that's supposed to be the years or so. So there was no remote control, no satellites. There was no computers, but I sensed they were tapping into me somehow. And they went, oh, he's waking up. Augmented telepathy, you know? They just did the communication when my head is waking up. They yelled out a numerical code, not of our numerical system. And he starts talking about these alien sounds that he heard. And he goes, and it went, and I can almost feel the plug like an electrical charge leaving. Zapped into their ship, put a light on in this ship where I see shadows of these creatures. And I woke up in my house and my bed. My room was infinitely white. I couldn't move. I was completely paralyzed. My eyes were open, and all of a sudden, bam, it just went black. It was the time it was. I broke into a sweat. I was shaking, and I felt like my body was drained. And from that moment on, I believed in UFOs. I started looking into astronomy. I became a junior astronomer, and I started figuring out. Till before that day, I never even looked at the sky and thought of anything except for there's a lot of stars up there. But yeah, it's a very unique experience. And from that day on, I believe hard. And you know, the universe and the UFOs and creatures, the thought of us being the only ones in this giant universe, when you know a little bit about astronomy, you know how big the universe is and what a speck of nothing we are. that to think that we're the only ones is pretty screwy. Those people are crazier than the guys who believe in UFOs. But I think there's a whole bunch of different ones. And they're all over out there. There's all kinds of dimensions. And I don't think that they were programming me. I think they were just interested, like, you know, we do with animals. So they had advanced technology, and they were just sucking my brain to see what I knew. And by catching them, enlightened me. I didn't learn anything. They didn't put something in my brain to make me special. I don't believe that at all. I just believe that by having that experience and realizing that it happened, my brain went boop. It was like taking acid. My mind expanded. And I started searching for, you know, the truth and things like that. And I still am. So JC comes back and says, and that was in the early 60s or early mid 60s. Did you have any experiences after that? Or was that the only time? He says, no, I've had a couple since then. Different ones, different people. These little gray creatures that were hanging out in Lake Placid. I had a house out there in the wilderness that had no electricity. Just a log cabin back in the early 80s, like 81 or 82. And these little guys are in the cabin one night. And, you know, even slamming doors, just I'm not saying, yeah, they were physical guys. I don't know if they were robots but it was freaky and scared me to death. And it's true. On every single year or albums, is there a song that's titled after space or something with frontier? This is JC again. Do you have a theme going that maybe not everyone picks up on, but is there a theme going with every one of your albums? And Sammy says, yeah. Space Station No. 5, first Montrose song. Second Montrose was out in 75 with Space Age Sacrifice. My first solo album, Hot Rocks, which changed into another song. But Silver Lights is about the return of the aliens coming back to check out their planet that they populated somehow, you know, propagated with, you know, planted seeds. The next album, Red, has Someone Out There. Next, Turn Up the Music had A Crack in the World on the record, as far as I can remember. Then I stopped doing it every album, but every now and then I got one on there. And JC says, awesome. Thank you, Sammy. We really appreciate it. And Sammy says, anybody that doesn't believe is crazy. So there y'all have it, folks. A little interview with Sammy Hagar that sounds like he got really touched. So I bring all this up to twist back on the fact is, are some of these musicians and some of you musicians listening out there, are y'all on a different frequency? Can music, they talk about math being like the ultimate language, right? The universal language. But is it music? Is it music that actually ties us together? Is that something that maybe the aliens, maybe this alien species can't create it? Maybe they've gone so far past what we are that they've lost touch with that more philosophical side, right? With that more in tune side. They're so worried about space and technology that they've lost some of that. Because there's always a give and take. There's always a price to pay. No matter what it is, right? Did Mr. Kramer stumble onto some very significant facial recognition technology, pushing it to do good? And was he done away with because of it? Did Mr. Sullivan actually have contact with aliens that he never spoke anybody about? And or did he see something out there that led him to walk off into the desert, never to be seen again? Or is it all just simply depression? Is it hard times that got to this group of people? I don't know. I have no idea. Either way, it's sad. Loved ones gone missing is terrible, and it's sad, and I hate it for each and every person that's ever been through it. But I hope you've enjoyed some of these strange rock and roll UFO stories and conspiracy stuff. I've enjoyed bringing it to you. Let's take a quick break, and we'll crack open the balding head of Philly Filson and see what he thinks. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives.
What One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
And there we go. The Red Rockers had some crazy experiences, a couple of missing rockers. Like, I don't know. I don't have any idea. Like, it sounds like it could have easily been depression. It could have easily been something like that, that they may have taken their own lives, the first couple of guys. But then again, maybe Jim did go off with a UFO. Maybe, I mean, he was in an area that had seen him and he was down with it. And, you know, we don't know about
that. What was that Canadian boy that went missing and they believe that he got on a UFO and never returned?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I forgot about that one.
Taylor Granger or something like that. I'd have to look up the name. But yeah, a similar thing. He was fascinated by UFOs.
Built the one in his backyard, like a house thing he was in. Yeah. And then one day he's gone.
Yeah. They picked him up.
They come and got him. Let's just say you were single, right? No family. You were just, you know, you didn't have a wife, kids, and all that stuff. And you got the opportunity, something like that. You're out in the woods hunting. You're in some strange place. These aliens start talking to you telepathically.
Now, what kind of aliens? Are we talking like grays or are we talking like the Nordiques? Because the Nordiques are like beautiful blonde-haired women.
So you would go with them without even talking to them. See, I'm talking about the grays. We're talking about the grays. Where you know it's a – you don't even have a question that it's an alien. You know it's an alien. And it's like, hey, man – you want to come ride around with us for a while? We'll show you some cool stuff.
I think I would do it if they would promise me that if I wanted to come home, they'd bring me home. That if it was like the kind of deal, it's like, well, we're not telling you that. It's either yes, you want to go or no.
Yeah.
I might be hesitant. But if they're like, hey, man, it's like Rumspringa. You can come chill with us for a year and then we'll bring you back. I might be like, huh.
Yeah.
It might be worth checking it out.
Like the Guardians of the Galaxy thing. Like, can you imagine living that Peter Quill life?
Yeah, because maybe there's a world on another planet that's like way better than here.
Were people like you?
Yes.
Yes, dude, you might need to find an alien.
That's what I'm saying.
Dude, you might be
pretty cool. It all depends on what they want. Now, if they want something from me, like they're going to harvest my organs, I don't know if I'm making that deal.
Nah, they definitely wouldn't want to harvest anything from you
now. But then I might, man, now you got me thinking, maybe they're lying to me, right? They're trying to like,
No, don't overthink it. Let's just say that they are straight up being cool as all get out.
They're just cool.
Like they get their kicks off of taking lower intelligent life forms and expanding their thinking by bringing them into space and showing them things.
Are you saying
like
they
that.
Like to expand their perspective?
I think so. Especially you need yours done that way in space.
Yeah.
So that's what I'm saying. I'm just like,
I think
cool
I
dudes.
Would. I think I got, if I got to make the decision, I would do it.
I think I would have to.
Yeah. It'd be
I
like,
I think I would have to.
It'd like be, it would be like being a foreign exchange student for a little while.
Yeah.
You know? But I would always want the option to be able to come home.
Yeah, I would want to be able to come back.
But then you could never tell nobody because nobody would believe you.
But I think by the time you experienced something like that and spent a year, 2, 5 years before you come home, what would be the point of telling them?
Well, that's not
they
true.
They could never wrap their mind around it.
I guess you could tell your story. You could come back and you could tell everybody about your experiences. You could probably get a job on Gaia explaining everything. You know, kind of like the guys do that are in the secret space army, you know, that fight
rooms in Mars
and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Like those guys make a whole career out of that.
Well, see, you
Secret
could go
Service
there
or military
and
fighting.
See if they're really up there. Just show up with the other aliens like, hey, what's up? What is that show? It's Paul.
What?
Paul, the alien movie Paul. Is it Simon Pegg and his, man, what's the two?
I don't even know what you're talking about.
Yeah, from Shaun of the Dead. It's got the alien Paul.
Oh, okay. I got you.
Yeah,
I'm
remember he
now.
Just shows up and he's hanging out, riding around in a motorhome with him.
I thought there was like a movie called Paul. I'm like, I don't remember the movie Paul. I remember the alien dude in a movie, but the name of the movie was Paul.
I believe it's Paul.
No.
We'll have to look it up. People are screaming right now. But anyhow.
I hope that there's aliens living in caverns under the earth. That's what I hope. The one that Philip Schneider had a battle with in the Green Beret. Shot his fingers off, killed the Green Beret.
Man.
I hope that they're dingy and they stink. They smell like hot, hot trash. You know, that's what they always tell you. And they're down there doing stuff. They're making insect-eyed kangaroo monkey
hybrids. Yeah, that's what they're doing.
I hope that's real.
You just want to get into a fight with one of them. Like, you could have the Battle of V, where we got laser guns and we're shooting, like, lizard men. That wouldn't be too bad, right?
Yeah, I'd like to grapple one.
Ooh, I wouldn't. Since when they touch you, they had, like, that acid or whatever that's on them. You can't be anywhere near the lizard.
Their limbs
people.
Look real thin, though, the grays, though. It looks like you could really
now,
just...
Now, you could probably beat up a gray probably pretty easy.
Snap that thing in half.
Just a solid leg kick and just shatter their hip bone.
Yeah.
And then you could run away. But then if they ever get that mind, like if you fail your intelligence save, you're done for. And you would fail it.
I got another story for you, Brad.
Yeah, lay it on me.
Check this out. It says, in the 1980s, my dad was stationed at the Alameda Naval Air Station near San Francisco.
That's a funny brag, but okay.
He and some of his shipmates decided to go camping while on leave. They drove to a sporting goods store near Berkeley to get what they needed. Now, while there, they met two professors from the University of Berkeley. These two professors were greenhorns, as my dad liked to call them, and knew nothing about camping or supplies. So they asked my dad to help them pick out what they needed. Then they told my dad that a logging company had contacted them at the university and asked them to come up to Northern California and investigate some large, animal-destroying things in one of their logging camps. They told my dad that someone or something was causing havoc in the area, and the workers couldn't get anything done. It was terrifying the loggers. My dad explained to the professors that he and his family operated as hunting guides in western Colorado. So, he was skilled at tracking. They asked if he and his buddies wanted to come up with them and help track. I don't know exactly where they went, but I remember it was near the California-Oregon state line, and I believe close to the ocean, but I could be off on that detail. He said that when they got to the camp and scouted the area around there, they found several giant footprints and made plaster casts of them. He said it looked like something or someone was scouting or walking around the camp's perimeter. He said the workers took them to a fuel depot where there were several footprints up to a collection of 55-gallon drums of diesel fuel. I wonder if they're attracted to diesel, like wild pigs are.
The way they like it
diesel
on corn.
Yeah.
They might.
We should try that.
Bring in the big feet.
Something had walked up to, then around this depot, finally picked up one of the barrels, and then carried it off towards a nearby ravine. He said that the footprints had become significantly deeper as the creature walked away from the fuel storage area, which would indicate that whatever had picked up the barrel had carried it without setting it down and then threw both the barrel and also a large tractor tire into the ravine. Then it walked back into the woods. They had a fire that night, and everyone was sitting around it drinking beers and shooting the breeze. And after a while, my dad said he noticed eye shine that appeared 8 to 9 feet high just outside the firelight, watching them. He told me he quietly worked his way back from the group and then circled the camp as quietly as possible to sneak up on whatever this was nearby. He said that no matter how hard he tried, including removing his boots and trying to sneak up in his socks, he never could get anywhere near whatever creature had the eye shine. It frustrated him as a professional tracker because he couldn't get close to the animal. He'd return to the group, and about 10 minutes later, the eye shine would return, and he'd quietly try to sneak up on it again. Now, over the years, I asked him several times, "Do you think that was Bigfoot?" Immediately, he would respond, "No, no, I can't say it was a Bigfoot because I never actually saw the animal. However, we did find some huge footprint tracks. I know that there was something huge out there, and that was a better tracker than I was. And whatever it was, it had large, large feet. But exactly what I saw out there, I honestly have no idea what it was." Now, was my dad telling me the truth, or was he just spinning a yarn? I don't know. However, he was telling the truth about something. As I've thought about this story more and more, I've come to the following conclusions. He saw something in Northern California that he could neither catch nor track down, which frustrated him as a professional tracker. He never altered the significant parts of the story. He may have added some details or forgot to share them. However, the incidents were identical points. He never claimed to have seen a Bigfoot. If he had, maybe he would have bragged about it. I wonder if the story grew from the Patterson-Gimlin encounter. Maybe, but nothing at least screams that. But I could be wrong. Jay. Man, maybe your dad saw one. I like how his dad was never coming forward and saying, "Look, I saw a Bigfoot." He's like, "Man, I don't know what he saw." Interesting enough, he said his dad was a professional hunter and tracker
yeah.
and guide in the Wolf Creek Pass area, which is where we go all the mm-hmm. time. So you're talking about a skilled outdoorsman. He mentioned taking his boots off to try to sneak up on it. That is something that a person that's a serious hunter would do. So, I mean, all the points are hitting, but he never said it was a Bigfoot. So that's why I'm inclined to believe this story. He said he saw something he can't explain, which I appreciate over people instantly saying, oh, yeah, I saw Bigfoot.
Yeah.
Because if he didn't really see it, don't make that judgment.
What's Bigfoot need with diesel?
Like I said, maybe like wild pigs. So the people may not know. Wild hogs here in Texas, you sour corn and they love it. But there are people that put diesel on the corn.
I mean, it used to be much cheaper. And they could put diesel on it.
And they just love it.
Yeah.
So maybe Bigfoot is into it. And see, when you put the diesel on the corn, the deer don't come to it. The deer don't want nothing to do with it. But yeah, the pigs love it, right? I don't know. Crazy.
If this thing picks it up, I remember my dad getting 55-gallon drums of diesel delivered. At the house when I was a kid. And I remember watching
the tractors and stuff. Yeah,
I remember watching the guy unload it. And the guy always had like a big just a rubber tire, right? Just in the back of the truck. No rim, just a tire. He would throw that out on the ground and roll that barrel out where it would land on that tire and then fight like heck to get it stood back up before you could move it. This is back before they had all, you know, nobody had the lift gates and all that stuff. This is just guys delivering
Tommy lifts and stuff.
Yeah, nobody was messing with that. But water is 8.34 pounds a gallon is what it weighs, I believe. So you're talking 484 pounds if the barrel is full of water.
Yeah.
So let's just roughly say diesel is the same. This thing picks it up and totes it off.
Yeah, just carries it.
Yeah, on its shoulder, I suppose.
And then just throws it into a ravine.
Just hucks it. So near 500 pounds. Mm-hmm. That's, man. So, and now, I guess, if it's empty and it's a metal drum, aren't they like 50 pounds? They're a little less than 50. I think they're like 48 pounds.
Yeah, something
is like what that. A metal drum weighs. So, like, that's not terrible. You can sling a metal drum around.
And he threw a large tractor tire into the ravine, too. That reminds me a lot of the sightings over there in Lake Worth. Remember, that's what the story was, is this thing was throwing tires up on top of this hill.
We stood on the hill with Lyle down at the bottom. Micah was with us. We were all out there, and Lyle's like, right there is where it was supposed to be, and here's where, you know, the tires and all this landed. Dude, it was cool.
Very, very cool story. If you have any cool stories you'd like to share with me and Cam, please send them in. You can email the show, expandedperspectives@yahoo.com. You can always call the show. We like to hear you tell it.
Yeah.
It's your story. 888-393-2783. You can call in and leave the story, and maybe it'll grace the fine listeners here on Expanded Perspectives. Let's not forget about our live show that's coming up.
Yeah.
In Nashville, Tennessee, at the Fisher Center at Belmont University, August 3rd, 2024, Squatchella. It's going to be a blast. Tony Merkel's going to be there. Blurry Creatures is going to be there. Ninjas or Butterflies are going to be there. We're going to have a good time. There's going to be some special guests there as well that they haven't announced yet. It's going to be cool. Go to Squatchella.com to get your tickets. I've already got messages from lots of people that are already going. Yeah. I'm looking forward to seeing them, hanging out with them, shaking hands, telling stories, telling lies.
It's going to have all kinds of fun.
It's going to be.
It's a beautiful place. So that's what makes it even better.
Oh, man. Right? Yeah, if you look up the Fisher Center in Nashville, Tennessee, it's ridiculous.
So beautiful.
It's going to be a wild time. We're going to have merch there, not just Expanded Perspectives merch, but the actual Squatchella merch.
All that'll be there. I think they're going to have more vendors there.
There's going to be some vendors there. Yeah, it's pretty cool.
It's going to be a big deal. Come hang out with us.
You get to hang out with Nate, Luke.
It's going to be an all-day affair.
Josh, so just come hang out. Andrew, Andy. It's going to be a good time.
Yeah, it'll be great.
Go over there. You can follow the show on social media, like Instagram and stuff like that. Keep up on updates like this. And don't forget, if you want more Expanded Perspectives, go to our Patreon. Go to patreon.com/expandedperspectivesElite, or just get on the Patreon app and search up Expanded Perspectives. You'll find us over there. You can sign up for $5 a month. You get ad-free versions of the show, as well as new elite episodes. And for right now, it's going to change pretty soon. But for right now, for $5, you can go back and get the entire back catalog. So go to Patreon right now. Cam?
Yeah.
It's beautiful outside. It's 75 degrees. It's sunny. We don't get too many days like Texas. Probably like 15 a year. It's going to be in the 100s soon. So what do you got lined up for your weekend?
Archery. I'm going to take the Bob Lee, and I'm going to go compete in a 3D tournament.
That's pretty cool.
I've been shooting like crazy, like dumping around. I think I'd probably average 70 to 80 shots a day is kind of what I average down to now. I try to pump in, you know, I was knocking down 100. Sometimes I knock down more, sometimes less, but that's kind of what I average, just shy of 100.
Man, I wish I had the time to do that.
I go out at night and do it. I've been doing a lot of blind bell stuff. So I have the light on, no target, nothing like that. Just stand about 10 yards in front of it, come to full draw, and just hold anchor and just work through the whole shot process.
Good idea.
So I do that in the evenings to just get shots off. And then in the daylight, I will go out and do it focused on target.
I will pick up my shooting when the Stanley Cup playoffs are over. Right now, there's so many good games on that that's pretty much consuming every evening at night. I might be taking Luke to Texas Frightmares this weekend.
Oh, you better.
Who wants to go over there? And, of course, he likes to see all the cool costumes.
Lyle, I bet Lyle will be there.
Yeah, I saw actually Lyle's one that told me about it. I'm like, man, I wish you would have told me earlier. He told me like 2 days before the event. It was like one day after the internet. Tickets, they didn't sell. Now you can only buy them if you show up in person. So it's like, man, but that's what it is. I know you're having problems with the internet at your house. I was having problems at my office.
It may be the weather. As much rain as we've received lately and all that, it may simply be the weather. So I'm just kind of waiting to see how that turns out.
All right. That is cool. That's about all the time we have for this episode of Expanded Perspectives. Till next time, folks, be safe. I'm Kyle. He's Cam.
Peace, y'all.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.